Good evening. Welcome to the Solari Report. I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Tonight, Money and Markets, then Precious Metals Market Report with Franklin Sanders. A lot to talk about. Is a correction coming or not, and what is our prediction for the silver high for the year? Our theme tonight is who's your farmer, who's your banker, where's your money? If you come into our website for many years now, you'll notice that's the slogan. Franklin put out a new piece this week on the money changers, steps to be rebuilding your local economy in the next 30 days, and asked the question, who's your merchant, who's your farmer, who's your banker? The reason why is as the liquidity squeezes out, particularly among the outsiders, and the shift, the repositioning of the economy, the repricing of everything accelerates, we all are going to be coming back to the day-to-day choices that we make and the power of those choices and changes in those choices to change our world, particularly as they ripple out in our networks and the network shift. Money and Markets, big announcement of the week. The Germans are negotiating Deutsche Bank to buy the New York Stock Exchange. That is a profound shift in control. There's a story behind that. Let's see what plays out, but it's one we're going to be talking about. As QE2 finishes up, real fear about Freddie and Fannie and what's going to happen. QE2 has been creating and keeping the liquidity going in the mortgage-backed securities market. The administration says they're making announcements tomorrow on what the options for ramping Fannie and Freddie down, but expect a lot less money to be going into the mortgage markets. We saw one of the leading economists in China announce this or recommend this week that China sell its $500 billion, half a trillion dollars of agency paper in anticipation of whatever happens. God bless Dennis Kucinich. The Patriot Act was up for extended. Kucinich led a group 2 days ago that got the extension to fail. Unfortunately, the Republicans rallied a lot more Republicans to their side and got it extended today. It's a perfect comment on what's going on in America that you would have someone who's considered a radical progressive arguing for basic constitutional freedoms while all the Republicans are trying to basically destroy it. All across America, we put several pieces up on the blog this week, reports coming in from subscribers, one on the weather in Phoenix, another from a wonderful reporter in New Mexico about the fact that gas had been out for 6 days in northern New Mexico and having very dramatic impact. They refer to it as a mini Katrina. But it all comes under the rubric of what I talked about in the year-end wrap-up called weird weather. We're having phenomenal cold down here. Tennessee for 2 days running this week looked like Montana. But we're having very weird weather, very warm in California, very cold in many parts of the country. And one of the things that people are noticing is extraordinary increases in their energy and food bills. And part is the weird weather, part is the debasement of the currency, but it's something that's really got everybody noticing. We've talked last week about the food riots around the world. It's not just here, it's a global phenomena, and it's all part of the debasement. But expect weird weather to be with us and to be a major conversation during 2011. Let me also mention we have now posted at the link for the year-end wrap-up. We did a written and graphical version of the year-end wrap-up, and I really encourage you to get a copy because reading it through it again in written form with graphs and links will really help you get a wonderful framework. Again, we talked about the deeper themes in 2010, but the ones that are going to be carrying over in 2011. So I really recommend that document to you. Again, you can find the link up on the in your control panel next to the MP3 for the year-end wrap-up first week in January. Oil and gas, politics all around the world. We're watching tremendous warfare going on both on gas and oil. I put a post up on the blog about PetroChina buying half of the shale gas project from one of the big Canadian firms for $5.4 billion. And underneath posted some of the links we noticed over the last week of real hiccups in gas and oil supply, particularly what looks to be covert operations. We have a pirates grabbing a freighter, explosions on several gas pipelines, the Egyptian situation causing gas supplies to Israel to be interrupted. So real politics going on around oil and gas. The greatest blooper of the week, God love her for this, U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton in an interview with a Mexican newscaster says the United States cannot legalize drugs as a means of fighting the black market because, are you ready for this, quote, there is just too much money in it. So Hillary Clinton gets the Honest Woman of the Week award. Anyway, Clinton says, quote, you can't legalize small amounts for possession, but those who are making so much money selling it, they have to be stopped. Means they can't compete with us. They can't be given an even easier road to take because they would then find it in their interest to addict even more young people. I guess Clinton hasn't looked into statistics on the psychotropic drugs lately. Line management liabilities are getting riskier and riskier. One of the subscriber points out that the COO of Freddie Mac resigned. Kevin Warsh resigned from the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve, and the CFO of Wells Fargo, Howard Atkins, retired. They wrote me a note saying, oh, starting to smell like your slow burn might soon turn into a much faster burn. I wrote back as follows. Bet you a dollar the slow burn continues to the end of 2011. These are small guys who are burnt out and cannot afford to play. They don't want to be the fall guys. 100 eager to replace each one. What will happen is the deterioration of quality will continue as more and more toadies enter the machinery, which will support the switch from sovereign government and government credit to private equity, which will help the boys and increase their power. So my bet is still for the slow burn, but clearly the change is accelerating. And what is ahead for the bond market when QE2 ends is really a very big question mark hanging over a very big bond market, and of course relevant to what we all look at in precious metals, because the risk is a lot of money leaves the bond market looking for a tangible place to go. The Egyptian situation continues. A very interesting note from Jim Willey. He calculated the fortune that Mubarak is estimated to leave Egypt with, and estimated that it was 50% or more of the U.S. aid to Egypt since 1981. And I thought I would underscore, rather than have Mubarak take the blame for all of that, in a situation like that, let's say 50%, let's say it's true, let's say 50% of the U.S. aid that went to Egypt never went into the to the benefit of the country or the people, but instead was funneled by Mubarak back into banks in London and New York. Technically it's under his name, or Switzerland. Technically it's under his name, but of course the money managers in Switzerland and London and New York control the money and are using it to finance Monsanto or whatever they're doing. At the end of the day, you have to really say, whose money really is it? If anything, Mubarak is just the face. Anyway, it's very important when you look at those money flows to learn to look behind the veil. Sometimes I think, you know, everybody's a front. Interestingly enough, one of the mainstream newscasters compared Mubarak and his billions to Gates and Buffett. Willie said, how inappropriate is that? I would say very appropriate. Anyway, so a very interesting time in money and markets this week. Again, the shift is accelerating. Watch what happens to the New York Exchange. That's going to be a very important story. Watch the Fannie Mae announcement tomorrow. Okay, Ask Catherine. We're skipping ahead, and our questions are going to be with Franklin this evening. We have a lot to cover. Franklin, are you with us?
Oh, I'm right here.
Okay. Well, just for everybody to know, I have not been in Tennessee for 2 months, so I just had dinner with Franklin and Susan. And I have to tell you, Franklin, it's really nice to be here in Tennessee with you both.
Well, it's great to have you here, too.
Well, tell us, you know, I said a correction would start by early February, but we see no signs of it. Tell us what your charts say. Tell us what you think. Are we going to get a correction in precious metals or not?
Well, we got a correction off of the high that occurred on the 3rd of January, but it did not go down. It wasn't even 15% in silver. And the difficulty for me is that if you look at past major lows in the gold-silver ratio, you expect silver to correct 30% at least.
Which is a big correction.
Oh,
if we're at $30 now, That's 21. That's correcting down to 21.
$21, $22, yeah. And of course, we haven't seen anything like that. And we see the stock market continues to rise. Well, one of the relations that's well known among people who look at market spreads is that gold tends to do better when the stock market does worse. Silver tends to do better when the stock market does better. So, in other words, the gold-silver ratio follows the course of or silver follows the course of stocks, and when stocks are rising, silver tends to outperform gold. And you've had this long run in stocks, and there's a question in my mind if I look at indicators that compare that show the market's enthusiasm for risk. It looks like those indicators may be topping, and if they do, that means that the next 6 to 12 months for silver will be difficult. And there's a little bit of ambiguity in the market, but there's nothing that you could say proves that silver and gold are not going to go up and make one more rally before they enter into a serious correction. So for right now, you have to say it's going up, but tomorrow, if silver doesn't hold on above, well, 2980 or so, and gold doesn't hold on above about 1355, then they may enter into a more serious correction. But you could get this leapfrog up to, you know, $1,500, $34 for silver. You could see a ratio that goes as low as 41 before this is over. But it's kind of tearing me up because it doesn't comport with the way that these lows in the gold-silver ratio have behaved before. And so I just have to throw up my hands and say, well, the market's going to do what the market wants to do. And, you know, I just have to stand back and watch. But I do think, back to this question of cross-market performance, I don't see how the stocks are going to keep on doing what they're doing.
Oh, I do.
Well, okay. But, I mean, from a fundamental economic reason, there's no reason.
Oh, right, right. From fundamental economics, there's no reason why they should keep doing what they're doing. And that may have something to do why the Germans have shown up.
You mean they'll add more credibility by buying out the New York Stock Exchange?
Well, the New York Stock Exchange has run out a lot of their credibility.
Right.
So the New York Stock Exchange has a real credibility issue, and you know, and they've spent a lot of money holding the market up. So has the central bank. So, you know, how much of QE2 has gone into making it possible for the market to stay up? Who knows?
But well, I came to the conclusion a long time ago that both the Fed and the administration equate or believe that they equate, believe that the public equates stock market performance with economic performance.
Right.
And therefore, it's like the Potemkin indicator. And as long as the stock market is up, all's well in the world. Now, you and I know that's not at all true, but I think that that's the way they think. I mean, that is their showpiece indicator. And
right.
If they can keep the stock market up, then you know, everything's okay.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, I reported to you at dinner, you weren't aware of it, that there's been reports that the Dutch Central Bank is pressuring one of the Dutch pension funds to sell their gold, saying it's their position is inappropriate. It's an inappropriate investment for a pension fund. They have too much.
Mm.
Want to comment on that?
Well, it's not a precedent that I like. It's a very bad sign. I don't know if this was a private pension fund or a public pension fund, but clearly gold is the enemy of central banks. And so if they're saying that, I mean, what would prevent the U.S. Federal Reserve to say that? And there are not many pension funds now that own gold. The Texas teacher retirement system, and I think the state retirement system come to mind as one of the few, but they have a position of like 1 or 2%. Which out of billions of dollars is a lot of money, but still not very much.
Well, the pension funds have, and the numbers will go up tomorrow on the blog if they haven't already, but the pension funds hold enormous amounts of dollar-denominated fixed income.
Right.
And it doesn't take the pension funds saying, wait a minute, we want a little bit more tangibles to cause an enormous swing.
Oh, certainly, yeah.
I
have no idea how many billions of dollars it is, but I would think it was somewhere north of probably $20 trillion.
Right. So the policies of the pension funds are very much right now have to be critical issues to the central bank.
Right. Well, they would always have an interest in preventing any movement out of paper assets, but especially if there were a large movement, yes.
Okay, well, I promised one subscriber who keeps asking that we would give our outlook for silver.
Mm-hmm.
So last month, which was our 2011 precious metals outlook, I said 1650 for gold, and you said 1740.
Mm-hmm.
You're much more, you were more optimistic in 2010, and you were right. So you're more optimistic on gold in 2011. So you want to give us yours? I'll give mine. Mine is 42, and I suspect you're going to be higher than me this year.
Well, you know, I thought about going with 25%, which would take silver up to about 38.75, and that just looked too low for me.
Uh-huh.
Because there's just no resistance between here and between $34 and $50 except the $39. And then I just did a little math, and I found that a rise to $50 would be a Fibonacci increase of 61.2% from the end of the year high. And so I think I'm going to go with that. I'm going to say I think it may make $50 by the end of the year.
Okay, well, I would propose that the winner this year, that the loser this year buy all the wine for the next year. Is that a deal?
Whoa! All right, I'll go for that. I'll spring for that.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit, big questions about the recent USDA announcements about GMO. And I'm always trying to make the connection between food and precious metals and freedom.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought we'd take another step in doing that this evening. You're both a precious metals dealer and a farmer. That's totally logical to me. If you're somebody who doesn't want to work or live in the tapeworm, you want to have financial security and you want to eat. So maybe if you could start by explaining these announcements by the USDA, what they mean and what they mean to you as a farmer.
Well, you know, a lot of what the USDA does doesn't really affect us because we're outside of that system. We're not organically certified. We don't want to be government certified. We don't have anything to do with that. But the problem is that any market has interconnections. And in this case, what happened was that Whole Foods and their wholesale distribution arm basically capitulated to the approval, USDA's approval of GMO alfalfa. And what you have to understand about alfalfa is a legume, like peanuts, okay, or clover. But it makes a hay that is extremely high in protein. And so it's used almost universally as a way to boost protein in animal feed. For instance, if you've got cows and you want dairy cows and you want to increase their production, then you feed them alfalfa, and they love it. They eat it up, and it increases your production. And it's the same. They used to feed it to pigs too. We feed it to ours, but most people don't feed it now. But it's the highest quality hay for horses that you can buy. Well, the problem with GMO anything, whether it's sugar beets or alfalfa or corn or whatever it is that you can't control the spread of pollen. You know, I mean, you plant a field of corn, and when it comes time to pollinate, the pollen's going to go everywhere, and it travels considerable distances. So what happened in Canada and what's shown to be the rule here in the United States is that when someone has a field next to a GMO field, Monsanto or whoever owns the patent on the GMO comes in and says, oh, well, your plants, your seed has GMOs in it, so you're poaching on our patent. And they effectively have squeezed out the market for open pollinated food. Now, if there's nothing wrong with GMOs, that's great, but there's a considerable body of evidence that suggests that GMOs are not safe for human or animal consumption. And so we don't want that. It's already very difficult. For instance, the corn in this country, about 80% of the corn, which is the limit of what the USDA allows farmers to plant, 80% of it is GMO. Well, we don't want to feed GMO corn to our pigs, so we have a farmer who raises, we take his 20% production in non-GMO corn. The problem is he plants them about the same time, so how do you know that they're not going to cross-pollinate? Well, the chances are they are going to cross-pollinate. And now if you do this with alfalfa, what it will do is drive out all the non-GMO alfalfa off the market. I mean, there won't be any. And you have to add to this the fact that the genetic treasury represented by all of these different varieties of open pollinated plants is disappearing under the onslaught of these GMOs. They literally drive everything else off the market. Well, if they were as good as they're supposed to be, everything, I guess, would be hunky-dory. But number one, there's the problem that when you genetically modify something, you don't know if you are also modifying it to create proteins that are not digestible or usable or might even be poisonous.
Right.
That's the first thing. The second thing is that it drives everything else off the market. And because of the Supreme Court decision that said it was patentable, that GMOs were patentable, then these people go in and they drive seed cleaners, they drive other farmers out of business. And so the choice is not as great as it would otherwise be. The problem is that you cause the genetic pool to shrink. And if you remember, in the 1840s, there was a potato famine in Ireland. For about the previous 150 years, the Irish had become almost completely dependent on potatoes for food. Suddenly, there was this blight that came in, and there were no potatoes that were resistant to it, and it wiped out the potato crop, and millions of Irishmen either starved to death or had to flee Ireland. There was no food, literally. Well, who's to say that some other blight won't come along that hits all of the, you know, all of Monsanto's Roundup Ready soybeans, or their, you know, the corn varieties that persist Roundup and all these other chemicals. I mean, if you have no genetic pool, then you have no backup against that event. So it's just, you know, it's just very bad practice to centralize everything so that you have nothing to fall back on at all. And that's the situation that American agriculture finds itself in. Now, for us personally, it's not a big problem because we're surrounded by paper company land. And I guess we could plant all the corn we wanted and never worry about it being cross-pollinated. But still, it's a problem when you try to go out and buy feed.
Right. It's a little bit like pouring red dye into one corner of the swimming pool at some point.
Right.
Exactly. One of the most frightening videos I ever saw was Jeffrey Smith, who I recommend is a great source of information on genetically modified food, put together three of his videos. He calls them the GMO Trilogy.
Mm-hmm.
And in one of them, it describes a scientist in Mexico who went and studied and tested the indigenous seed supply of many, many remote farming communities up in the mountains, very, very remote. And what he found was that a tremendous number of them were already compromised.
Mm.
And you watched and you listened to it and you thought, what are they doing, spraying genetically modified organisms into these areas? I mean, you can't fathom how it could have gotten there.
Well, yeah, I wouldn't think that pollen would travel much more than a mile, 2 miles. But then, I don't know.
Right. Well, I thought I'd just skip ahead. and just insert let's go to a movies here, because one of the things I want to suggest to people, the fun of trying to access and build your own local food supply comes from sort of organizing with like-minded people in your area who want to do it. And so one of the things I thought, I sat down and I said, okay, if I wanted to organize a potluck dinner and show documentaries or movies that would inspire everyone I know and love to really get with the program of building a local food supply, what would be the 10 movies and documentaries I would most pick? So I thought I would just run through them now. And the ones you've seen, Franklin, I want you to comment on. I've got 10 plus some runners-up, and I'll just go through the list. And we'll write this up and post it next to the link for the MP3. Okay, number one is my favorite, Sir James Goldsmith interview with Charlie Rose in 1994 on the GATT and global industrialization of agriculture. Now you've seen that one, Franklin.
Right. It's a fabulous piece of work. It's one of those fundamental things that changes your mind forever. Well, it does. It changes your mind. It sets your framework, and you say, okay, this is the framework that I have to understand things through.
Right. And what the thing that Goldsmith does in that video, which is so powerful, is he shows you how centralized, how top-down, and how absolutely frightening the vision is of central control of agriculture and seed and food supply. And you see it, and you realize, you know, if a billionaire is terrified about this in 1994, this is really real.
Right.
So, and that's up on the blog. If you just do a search for Sir James Goldsmith, you can get it up on the blog. Okay, the second one is a favorite of Franklin's, but he hasn't seen it. It's called The Oiling of America, and it's a speech by Sally Fallon of the Weston Price Foundation about the real truth about fats. And since you're a Weston Price aficionado, Franklin, why don't you explain Sally Fallon and the Oiling of America?
Well, Sally Fallon is the head of the Weston A. Price Foundation, and Weston A. Price is that foundation and Sally Fallon are sort of the epicenter of the whole food freedom movement. And I haven't seen that particular thing, but I know from the work on the website and the work in the magazine that what she exposes is that the entire war against lard and butter, you know, normal fats, in other words, natural fats, has been based on bad science, faulty premises, and just outright lies. And that has converted America away from healthy fats like lard and other fats to soybean oil and the worst of all, Crisco and margarine, which are terrible for your health.
I went into, when I was in Pennsylvania, it was late at night, so I went into the Acme, and I tried to find butter,
mm-hmm.
and there were maybe 100 different butter-like products, but I couldn't find any real butter. It was amazing. Okay, third is Super Size Me. Now, you've seen Super Size Me because we did it together on the Soleria Report.
It's a frightening movie. It's a really frightening movie, but obviously, what it shows is that if you eat a diet of nothing but fast food, Big Macs in this case, I think, and wasn't it Big Macs that he ate, or was it just that he had to eat it?
He had to eat. For 30 days, he had to. This is Morgan Spurlock, who's a documentary maker, wonderful young man whose girlfriend, now wife, is an organic chef, vegan, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he's in tip-top health, just, you know, all fresh food, very healthy, and decides for 30 days to eat at McDonald's.
And the doctor, and there's a wonderful scene where the doctor says, if you keep doing this, you're going to die.
My favorite is at the end, he piles up all the sugar he ate in a month in a mound of sugar in front of him, and you could faint. Anyway, so Super Size Me is one of the ones you want to give to teenagers in your life, your kids and your grandkids, your cousins. Get them to watch it, because you literally can change a 14-year-old. You can get a 14-year-old to say, you know, I'm never eating at McDonald's again. One of the ones I love is called Life and Debt in Jamaica, and I don't know if you've watched this one, Franklin.
No.
It talks about how sort of it takes you from the Sir James Goldsmith vision of how we're going to centralize agriculture, and describes the hit on one small island. and you see how the game, how basically the network, the IMF, the World Trade Organization, how they come in and basically take control of Jamaica, and Jamaica goes from an island with lots of local agriculture to exporting almost everything. You wipe out the small farmers and you destroy the local economies. And, you know, you create enormous unemployment. You kind of see how the game works at the at a country and local level, and it takes to Sir James Goldsmith and makes it much more human. So it's, now the interesting thing is when you watch it being done to Jamaica, you realize, oh, this is what's happening to America. Mm. It's a little bit more subtle here, but it's the same kind of process. The next one, Obesity Killer at Large. Now, have you seen that one, Franklin?
No, I haven't seen that.
That's up on the blog, and that describes the extent to which the food system is really making our children sick. It focuses on children as well as obesity. It's a little bit controversial among the food groups who think that we make the children out to, we make them look bad. You know, I think one of the powers of the Killer at Large video is it really, it's a documentary, it really helps you understand how venal the corporate policies are and the intentionality of doing what they know is really going to kill kids. So it's a little bit of a tough stuff. It's up on the blog. That one's available on the internet for free. The next one is Sugar, the Bitter Truth, which is a hour and a half video by Dr. Robert Lustig. It's just a lecture. He was giving a lecture at the University of San Francisco, and somebody recorded it and put it up on the internet, and he became an overnight internet sensation. And it's really an hour and a half that will, when you're through, you will be, if you have a sugar addiction, you're ready to give up sugar. It's the most persuasive argument to get you to walk away from sugar I've ever seen. Sugar, the Bitter Truth. The next one is The World According to Monsanto. Very interesting documentary. Have you seen that one, Franklin?
No, I haven't seen that.
That one was made by a documentary maker in France who just started pulling stuff off the internet from various sources and piecing it together. That one, again, is available for free. The next one, The Unhealthy Truth, is a video interview of a woman named Robin O'Brien, who was a very successful security analyst who retired, had kids, and then was faced with what the food she was cooking and making for them was doing to them. And she is simply just so persuasive. I think I sent that one to you, but I never followed up and asked you if you'd seen it. She is just very, very persuasive and tells it from the point of view of a mother. And if you're a busy mother, how in the world do you get off of, you know, the mainstream food system and start to access sources that really protect your kids? The next one is The Real Deal on Farmer John. Now, I know you've seen that one, Franklin.
No, I haven't.
You haven't?
Sorry. I haven't seen it.
I have to get that one for you. The Real Deal on Farmer John is the story of a young farmer who grows up on his dad's farm and is literally bankrupted by the feds by their talking him into a lot of debt and then pulling their subsidies in the early 80s and then reinventing himself as a very successful organic farmer who ends up being so successful with the CSA outside of Illinois that the different members of the CSA have to help finance him buying more land. And it's really the story of a farmer who just won't give up being a farmer, and he just keeps going until he finds a way to make really healthy, fresh food. But you see him struggle at a very intimate level with the challenges of working in a food system which is steadily industrializing. The next one, which I know you've seen, is Food, Inc.
Oh, yes. Scary movie.
Well, why don't you tell us about it?
Well, what it does is it exposes the American corporate food system and food processors, and by the time you're finished with it, you'll never eat any more processed food or commercial, you know, commercial meat or chicken again. I mean, it's just, and it's amazing. You know, people tell on themselves, and a lot of times they're not even aware of it, and there's a lot of that in that movie, that what comes through is that, you know, a lot of the people who are enmeshed in producing this stuff really don't get it themselves.
Right.
And in a certain sense, they're victims of the system, too. You know, they just are told to do this, that, or the other. But that's one I would recommend everybody see. Very, very good. Very well done.
And that's, when did that come out? Do you remember?
Oh, it hasn't been too long. Last, what, 4 years, 5 years at the most? 3 years?
Okay. GMO Trilogy, I mentioned, is a three DVD set from Jeffrey Smith. You can get it on his website. One of the things he has in that set is the story of the school in Wisconsin that went from basically feeding the kids junk food to feeding the kids all fresh, locally grown food, and watching literally a revolution, a transformation in their behavior and their ability to learn, and a dramatic drop in behavior problems. Have you seen that one, Franklin?
No, I've read his books, but I haven't seen that movie.
Okay, then the next one is not a documentary. It's a movie. It's called Soylent Green. And I know you've seen that one.
Oh, yes,
I've seen that
one years ago. Yeah.
You want to describe that?
No, I'll let you do that.
Okay, well, that is sort of your ultimate sci-fi horror movie about what happens when you allow the food system to deteriorate and be controlled by corporate interests who literally don't care about the people. And it's really pretty horrifying. I won't go into the details of how far it goes, but it's for those of you who like science fiction, you know, it's worth watching, and you'll often see references as GMO food is discussed to the Soylent Green movie. Finally, what I wanted to bring up is one that I haven't seen, but I did put the trailer up on the blog, and I can't wait to see it. It's called Scientists Under Attack. It's coming in March. And it is the story of the different efforts to silence scientists who report negative research findings on genetically modified food and seed. And if you want to understand the dangers of genetically modified food, you really want to understand the forces that have been brought to bear to pressure scientists to lie about this stuff. It's really quite extraordinary. So if you're interested, the trailer is up on the blog. So we'll put that list up, but if you're looking to really persuade everyone that building a local food supply is not a question of price, it's an absolute necessity. I'm hoping that those will help you get yourself educated and organized. Okay, well, Franklin, given the importance of food, you just published a very inspiring little piece. It's up on the blog. It's called The Money Changer's Step to Rebuilding Your Local Economy, and I was hoping you could tell us about it.
Well, this came out of a speech that I did in Baltimore about how to rebuild your local economy, and I realized after I did the speech that I explained what the problem was, and I explained why we had to rebuild local economies, but I neglected to give anybody any steps for doing it. And I broke it down under four headings. Who's your merchant? Who's your farmer? Who's your banker? And where's your charity? And the thing is that we have to understand, if we're going to build our local economy, we're going to have to create a cash flow within our own area that stays there. And if you go down to, you know, the national chains like Walmart or Lowe's or the big box stores, then your money is going to go out of the economy. It's going to go to New York or Bentonville or wherever their headquarters is. And then what that means is that everybody in your economy, in your locality, is going to do next year what they did this year. They've got to go outside the county. They've got to drag money back in, find money somewhere and drag it back in so they can spend it again with all of these national chains. And then they'll send it out of the county again, and you're going to be on the same treadmill the rest of your life. So the first thing you have to do is to patronize local merchants, and I think we have to make it a moral issue because it is a moral issue. You have to explain to your neighbors, look, you're financing the destruction of our prosperity in this county, in our community, because you won't buy locally. And the only way we're ever going to rebuild the economy is for you to buy locally. So in line with that, the idea, the best thing to, you know, one of the little places you can start is to start a buy local campaign. Now, unfortunately, you know, people think, well, I'll just go to my county commissioner, or my county commission, or the local chamber of commerce, and they'll just jump right onto that. Well, they may not jump right onto that. In fact, they probably won't. But you know, you can go out and for $500 or $250, you could have 500 or 1,000 bumper stickers printed up that say, "Buy local." You know, shop in XYZ county first. You know, and doing that, you go to your local merchants, your local hardware store, your local grocer, your local bakery, and you say, "Hey, would you like to hand out 15 or 20 of these bumper stickers?" Of course they're going to. They're going
right.
to help you do it.
Right.
And then, you know, I showed this list to my son and daughter, Justin and Liberty, and they looked at it, and Justin said, "Well, you know, you've left something off of there." I said, "What?" He said, "Well, you're going to have to tell people that it's going to cost them more to do that." And the truth is, it is going to cost more. You're going to pay more because you're buying more. You know, one of the things that you're paying for is prosperity for your neighbor. One of the things that you're paying for is prosperity for your local community. And you may have to spend more to get that, because the chances are that your local grocery, or you're certainly not your local farmer, is going to be as cheap as Walmart. But the thing that you're getting is prosperity for all your neighbors and ongoing prosperity for yourself, because if your neighbors don't prosper, you're not going to either, ultimately. So you have to put your money where your mouth is, what it amounts to.
Well, it's also a simple question with food, because now, you know, you can't, I don't know when, but it's not that long now when you can't get, when you go, whether it's Whole Foods or Walmart, you don't know what you're getting.
Oh, no.
You have no, you have, at this point, you have no reason to believe that that's food.
Right. And so in that case, well, you know, I think it boils down to something simpler in the case of food. Just go stand outside of Walmart for an hour, 30 minutes, 20 minutes, and look at the people who are going in and make a judgment about what their health is. One of the things that you're going to see is that there's going to be some large percentage of them that are suffering from great obesity. I mean, you just watch them going in. There's a reason why they've got those little motorized scooter shopping baskets. It's because a lot of the people are just simply too heavy to walk the distances in the store. They're eating cheap food.
Right.
It's cheap food. It's the cheapest food you can get. But it's doing that to them.
Right.
Because you know and I know that 50 years ago, you didn't see that kind of obesity or health problems, obvious health problems that you see. So yes, you're gonna pay more, but at the same time, you're gonna get chemical free, genetically pure, healthy food that's not loaded down with sugar and white flour. You're gonna get food that really nourishes your family.
One of the things that, you know, I'm not easily afraid, and one of the things that has scared me the most is watching people who've watched Super Size Me and watching Super Size Me circulate and clearly communicate what is in that food and what that food can do to you, and yet continue to eat a McDonald's. And I don't...
Well, I've got a friend and I were talking, Michael Peruk, I think you know him. Anyway, we were talking this last weekend about what he calls the mojo. And mojo is a voodoo word for spell. And it's true. People are under a spell. And it's they know what the dangers of the food are. They understand it, and yet their behavior never changes. That's how strong the mojo is. And it's just you see the same spell when people think about government activity. They all are against government spending and government control of the economy, except when it comes to their local neighborhood or to them, to their area or to them. And in that case, all they want to know is, how do I get my free government money?
Right.
And the fact is, the truth is, and you can prove this 100 different ways, government money always decapitalizes the people that take it.
Right.
It always ruins them. And yet they'll step and take it anyway. So I think one of the things, and we were talking about this at supper when we were discussing the prophetic imagination. The problem is that when you live in a society, you become so enculturated, so acculturated to what it is, that you become blind to its faults, and you accept all of the myth that that economy believes about itself, and that society believes about itself. And one of the problems that we've got is breaking through this idea that America has the best food distribution system and the best food in the world. That's not true.
I've spent a fair amount of time in Europe in the last year, and I can tell you that's complete bunk.
Well, yeah. I was going to say, anybody that's ever been to France or Germany can put the death to that lie. So, you know, we just... It's very hard, though, and this makes me very sympathetic toward the people who are the victims of that food system. It's very hard to break out from under it.
Well, I asked you to read Walter Brueggemann's book, Prophetic Imagination, because, you know, I'll just use your steps to rebuilding your local economy. I started to do that because I said, look, I just want to get as far away from this system as possible. There has to be another way. There just has to be another way. And one of the things I've realized, and it's taken me many years to realize it, is that one of the things you and I have in common is over the last 20 years, we just had remarkable good fortune to say, no, I'm not going along with that, I'm not doing that, well, there has to be another way. And, you know, off you go out to the wilderness looking for another way.
Mm-hmm.
So you just keep, it's like burning your boats, you just keep looking for it. But the most important step is to be able to imagine that another world is possible. And this is a very, very important step. And I had a series of conversations with different people and subscribers over Christmas that I told you about when they said, you know, it's so important to us to really be able to conceive that another world is possible. You know, we don't have to be part of the matrix.
Right, but the problem, again, back to the mojo, the problem is that the matrix causes, living in the matrix causes you to think in a certain way, and it causes you to be blind to certain things. Let me give you one little example. In this country, until, about 1950 or maybe 1960, the dream of every farmer, the dream of most people was to get up to pay for your property over the course of your life and then to leave it to your children unencumbered. Well, somehow about 1950 that changed and people began to depend on debt. And it was the same way with businesses. Businesses financed internally out of profits. They didn't depend on debt financing for their operations. They would have rejected that out of hand. Well, nowadays it's just exactly the opposite. So we're so used to debt financing that we don't understand the principle of equity financing. We don't understand that there's another way to do things, that it doesn't have to be done with debt. And so you have to challenge, you have to show people, look, there's another way to do things. There are a lot of ways that are possible to do the same thing. And we have to choose the one that's best for us, not the one that's best for the people in charge.
Right, but to do things a new way, you need a critical mass of people willing to do it, who are trustworthy to do it with you.
I think that's a dangerous thing to say.
Well?
Okay, and I'm going to tell you why I think
it's
a dangerous thing to say. Because if you say that, if you admit that, then everybody's holding back because they don't want to be the first one to spend their money and have it fail.
No,
And the fact is, you have to be willing to take the risk that you'll lead and nobody else will follow.
I agree. And that's what I did, and that's what you did, and that's what lots of other people are doing. But you have to be willing to say, I don't know if the other people will be there, but I'm going to have faith that they will be. And I'm going to find them, but even if I don't, I'm going to do it anyway. Okay?
Right.
You have to be willing to say, I'm going to jump in the water anyway and see what happens.
Right, and you know, I don't know whether you want to call it living life on the edge or whatever, but if you don't ever take risks, does life really have any meaning, or are you just a domesticated animal safe in your pen? I mean, I think that if something's right, there can't be a difference between what I know is right and what I do, Because if there's a difference between what I know is right and what I do, we have a word for that. And that word is hypocrite. Well, do you want to be a hypocrite? I mean, I'm not trying to push people to do beyond what they have courage to do, but I am trying to encourage them to have courage in their own lives, because courage pays off. I understand that it may mean that you'll take more bruises and more licks and more blows and wounds than other people, but courage pays off finally. And when you get to the end of the light of your life, do you want to look in the mirror and say, well, you know, put on my tombstone, he lived safe.
Here's what I will say. I would be in a situation where it was certifiably hopeless, and I would say, you know, we have this concept of standing. I would just say, no, I'm going to stand, because I don't have to do that, and I appreciate it's hopeless, but I'm just going to do the right thing. And then suddenly, everything would shift, and a way would open up that wasn't there before because I was willing to do that.
Right.
It was almost like certain windows can't open until you'll put your feet in the ground and you'll take a position.
Until you take the risk.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree that that's true. But if we all sit back, see, one of the worst things that's happened to us in the indoctrination under the American Empire is that we have been taught since we were in grade school, when we got up every time the bell rang like a bunch of Pavlov's little puppies, we were taught never to get out away from the crowd, never to do anything that the rest of the crowd was doing. Well, now, everybody knows, if they think about it, about 30 nanoseconds, that if humanity had always followed that rule of never getting out in front of the crowd, there would be no human progress.
I mean, there would be no humans.
There would be no humans, right, because all progress comes from those people who are not afraid to question the reigning civilization and the reigning way of thinking. And it's just necessary that you ask, is there a better way to do this? And I'm not saying that always there is a better way to do it, because, you know, traditions build up for a reason, but you have to be willing to question the society that you live in, and if it's wrong, you have to be willing to do things another way. And I know there are people who probably throw rocks at me for being un-American for saying this, but we live in a place that's in deep trouble. We live in a country that's in deep trouble and a culture that's in deep trouble.
Right.
And, you know, if your motive doesn't reach any higher than save yourself, you have to do something. You can't just sit back and, you know, wait for the end to come. It doesn't make any sense.
Right. Well, the reason, and we haven't really explained prophetic imagination, but really what Brueggemann's talking about is the ability to shift your mind outside the empire and imagine a world, a world that has freshness, a world that's alive, a world that is worth living, and not getting caught up in the hopelessness of empire. And one of the things he says, which I thought was so interesting, he said, is describing Moses leading the people out of Egypt, and he said the thing that killed the empire was that they lost interest in the empire and they stopped paying any attention to it. I thought that was pretty good. We have a question from a subscriber, and I should mention I'm having trouble accessing the questions on the teleseminar, so if I don't get them answered today, I'll collect them and make sure I get them answered in the future. What do you and Franklin think is the best approach to reforming sustainable farming?
Well, the chief thing is to get the government out of the way. The chief problem right now is that there are laws that force the circulation of bad food, that keep alternatives off the market. And if we could get rid of those government regulations, and some of them are state regulations and some of them are federal regulations, if we could get rid of those in 2-3 years, there would be a revolution in food production in this country.
You notice one of the legislators in Utah just proposed a new law saying that food grown and eaten in Utah was not subject to federal regulation. Now, we have 5 minutes, Franklin, and I wanted you to just take a little bit of time. And, you know, we've been doing the series, the top 10 dates in the history of precious metals and silver.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked you to think a little bit about the role that manipulation of gold and silver has played in the political control of farmers throughout American history.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe you could just say a few words about that.
Well, let me just make a demographic footnote first. You have to realize that as late as the 1930s, about 45% of the people in the country made their living off of agriculture. And if you look at the 19th century, it's going to be something like 85% of the people who made their living as farmers. So unlike today, and see, in 1990, the Census Bureau dropped the category for agricultural workers because it was such a small number that it didn't justify keeping up with less than 1% of people who work in agriculture, less than 1% of the workers who work in agriculture. So there's been a huge shift that way, and it's not just that we're rabidly pro-farmer or rabidly agrarian. The reason, from an economic standpoint, that we talk about these things is that the wealth of the world comes from the things men take out of the ground. And I'm going to say that again because it's a principle you have to understand. The wealth of the world comes from the things men take out of the ground, whether it's mining or agriculture. That's where everything starts. And as that dollar of agricultural income passes through the economy, it becomes $7 of national income as it's processed through the economy. So you see this begin. There's some of monetary manipulation trying to control prices or having an effect on agriculture and food production already in the teens and the 20s with the first and second banks of the United States. And of course you had Andrew Jackson, who broke those banks or broke the second bank of the United States simply because he saw the danger of that a corporation money power threatened the country with, that it threatened to take over the entire country. But when you get into the aftermath of the war between the states, you have to realize that the war between the states was a huge concentrating influence on the American economy, that before that time the economy was relatively small and there were no great aggregations of wealth. Those only took place after you had the war that furnished enormous amounts of money to suppliers to the federal government. For instance, you know, the DuPonts were just a small family with a sleepy little powder mill in Delaware, and of course the war made them fabulously wealthy, and all the speculators and bond floaters and the rest of the suppliers to government all during the war, those people became fabulously wealthy. And so you've got the period after the war which you know, they call the Golden Age. It was an age of great corruption. But at the same time, what was happening was you had what always occurs after a war. You had a deflation because there was much less spending on agricultural commodities and everything because there was decreased demand. People weren't burning up all of this production out in a war. So that had a downward effect on prices, but the government also pursued, under the influence of bondholders who had enormous political power, the government pursued a deflationary policy, and what that meant was that the farmer found himself squeezed and unable to make a living because the price that price that he received for his product kept going down and down and down. But a lot of the inputs did not go down. For example, there were cartels in the railway industry that kept freight rates high to rural areas. So the farmer is still having to pay high freight rates while the price that he's getting for his product goes down and down. So that whole period became associated with the populist movement, which came on toward the end of the 19th century, which was really a movement of farmers. And you find, and the pro-silver movement, well, the pro-centralization team, the bondholders, managed to have silver demonetized in 1873, and that increased and exacerbated the deflation, and it continued until you got another depression panic in the early 1890s. Well, that's about the time that the agitation from the populists for silver, a resumption of silver coinage, began, and of course reached its height with the presidential race of 1896 when William Jennings Bryan delivered that Cross of Gold speech. But you see the best example of that in L. Frank Baum's book, The Wizard of Oz. And I don't know if your listeners know about this or not. You can go on the internet and find out. But that is an allegory about the silver question, about the monetary question, and the way that the country was being squeezed by the moneyed interest. I mean, remember, there's a scarecrow in there, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the scarecrow is the farming interest. He's farmers. He represents farmers. And remember, there's a tin man, and he's mm-hmm. all rusted up. Well, he represents labor, the whole laboring class in America. And, of course, they're going to follow the yellow brick road, right?
Mm-hmm.
The gold brick road to Oz, which is green, which is the color of paper money. And there is the Wizard of Oz. There's a Cowardly Lion, which represents Bryan. And then there's the Wizard of Oz, which represents McKinley, who was the front man for those moneyed interests. So it's all in there in that book. It's all an allegory about this fight between the food producers and the money manipulators. And then after that period, things get better for farmers into the beginning of World War I, and you had this tremendous worldwide demand for food again that was caused by the war. And so farmers from about 1914 until 1920 were sitting in the catbird seat. They were making plenty of money. And then suddenly there was an agricultural depression that began in 1921 when the price of cotton went to a nickel a pound. And people were ruined. Farmers were ruined. They had increased production hugely by the introduction of the Fordson tractor in 1917. And now they found they couldn't make a living. Plus, they were now addicted to buying farm instead of using horses to using tractors, which they had to go off the farm to pay for, whereas before they raised them on the farm.
And you get them hooked on debt.
Right, and they were hooked on debt. They had to have money now. They didn't have to have money before because they raised most of their fuel. They raised their own motive power. Now all of a sudden they're really in trouble. And the whole period from 1920 until 1932, when the Depression started for the rest of the country, had already started for farmers. Farmers were already in trouble. And then, you know, and that was in large part a part of their entering the money economy instead of staying in the sort of semi-self-sufficient economy that they were in. Then comes Franklin Roosevelt, and of course, you can look at Franklin Roosevelt a lot of different ways, but I think the plainest and easiest way to understand him is he was the front man who rationalized all of the, who helped to rationalize all of the contradictions and problems of industrial capitalism. In other words, he came in and he had this air that he was the opponent of Wall Street. He was the front man for Wall Street. He was the one who was supposed to straighten things out. So he comes in with what appears to be a humanitarian program, that Social Security, for instance. The reason for that is so that you don't create a restless underclass proletariat. You've got the government taking care of them. So what you did was you shifted the weight of taking care of people in their infirmity and old age onto the government and off of producers. So what happened was that the laboring classes, the laboring people themselves, began to have to pay through Social Security for the support of people in their old age and infirmity. So,
well, the government accepted responsibility as long as the cash flows were positive. Since they just turned negative, let's see if it really works.
Yeah, exactly. But the point I'm trying to make, and I may not be very clear, but the point I'm trying to make is that there's been a struggle between the people who actually do the farming, create the food, grow the food, and the moneyed interest. Now, since 1948, what happened was in 1948, although the government entered into an agreement with farmers at the beginning of World War II, and the agreement was you'll get 80% of the relative price that you got in 1914, which was better for farmers than what they'd gotten through the 30s. But then come the end of the war, in 1948, that system of parity, as it's called, was overthrown, and the government instituted a policy called Get Big or Get Out, the agriculture, the U.S. Department of Agriculture did. And so they drummed it into farmers' heads that they had to either get big or get out, and that the best way for them to produce was to borrow money and go into debt for very expensive inputs like tractors, chemicals and so forth, fertilizers. And that was the time that the whole shift of farming from family farms to corporate farming took place. And you see the concentration of that by this time, 50 years later. You've got basically three big grain companies in the country. There are five, but three of them are the biggest. You've got two companies that process almost all the meat in the United States. You've got a limited number of companies that produce most of the meat in the sense of feeding it off if it's animal, if it's beef or pork or raising chickens. I mean, the industry is so concentrated that it's hard to conceive. You know, the numbers are, you know, when you say two people, two companies, two corporations process most of the beef in the United States, you scratch your head and say, that can't.
Well, think about it. Walmart has gone from 0 to 35% of the market share for groceries in 15 years.
Right.
So we're going to have to end here because we're sorely over our time. But one of the reasons I really appreciate your going through the history, Franklin, is it's so important. If we're going to have a prophetic imagination about a new world that's possible, we're going to have to get comfortable talking about food and currency, because rebuilding the local economy means understanding and addressing both of them.
Right.
So who's your farmer and who's your banker are two sides of the same coin.
Right.
Okay, so next week, Bankster Mine with Stuart Thompson. We're going to be talking a lot about the day-to-day, month-to-month, year-to-year games in economic warfare that we're watching in the markets. Stuart has a lifetime of experience tracing them and lots of feelings about them. March 3rd, Gwen Scott, Creating Natural Health in an Unnatural World, and then back again on March 10th with Franklin. So we now have a whole series of documentaries and movies to help you. Don't worry about whether there is a conspiracy or not. If you're not in one, then you need to start one. Good night and good luck.